Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We open with a conversation with best-selling writer James Frye. A little later in the hour, we'll talk with the author of a book called The Digital Divide, and you'll hear from the archives a conversation which I had a few years back with Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak. Stay with us. It's certainly not every day that I get the opportunity to speak with a author of the stature and talent of James Frye, best-selling author several times over, and very, very well known for the recent books which he has written under the overarching name of Endgame. And his most recent book is Sky Key, an Endgame novel, a sequel to the bestseller Endgame, The Calling. And it's really quite an unprecedented undertaking, a sort of a multi-platform project, the Endgame trilogy, ultimately, following 12 young teens as they play a life-or-death game that is absolutely riveting. 12 very different teenagers in what's been called a battle of logic and stealth that takes them all across the globe. The book is brilliantly written, and is going to see life as a major motion picture in the relatively near future. And I'm very excited to speak with James Frye about this latest undertaking in his career. Sky Key, an Endgame novel, again, is the latest in this work. James Frye, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks for having me.
I really appreciate this opportunity. This is a brilliantly conceived work, and in some respects, it's designed with young adults, I guess, in mind. Tell us who you had in mind as you first conceived the story, and what does it mean to couch something in those terms, to sort of aim it towards young adults? What does that mean? What does it mean for you as the person creating this?
I mean, I always say I want every reader in the world between the ages of 13 and 113, right? I want everybody to read the book, and I want everybody to love the book, and I want everybody to have fun with the book. The young adult has become a very popular genre. You know, books written with teenage characters, specifically targeted towards the teenage market. I would say, first and foremost, I always just try to write an awesome book. And I believe if you write a book that is fun and cool and keeps people up late at night and keeps them turning the pages, you're not just going to get teenagers or you're not just going to get adults. You're going to get a huge range of people. In this book, the characters happen to be teenagers. And I'm definitely hoping tons of teenagers read it. But really, I just wanted to write an awesome book. What I did with this book, which I think will appeal to teens, is we live in a very different world than we lived in 20 years ago. We live in a world with cell phones and iPads and the internet and social media and mobile video games. And so I wanted to create what I call the 21st century book, which is a book that exists on paper in the traditional manner, but within it also has opportunities for readers to move off those pages into the digital world, into the internet, a network of websites, into social media with social media sort of groups and pages and profiles, into YouTube where we have videos, and into mobile video games, and ultimately into movies.
Right.
So The books, Endgame was the first book in the series. Sky Key is the second book in the series. Each of them had a puzzle written into the text of the book. As you try to solve that puzzle, it takes you out into the digital world, into social media or YouTube or the internet.
I guess the term is convergent media, the idea that from the start you're conceiving something with all of these other possibilities as firmly conceived as the central book. I mean,
they're not just
springing up accidentally, and they're not the product of someone else's imagination. They are cohesively part of the imagination.
Yeah,
it was
all planned out beforehand.
Right.
You know, the idea was always to build an entire world, not just to write a book with the world within the pages, but to write a book with the world within the pages, and then an extension of the world out into the digital world and the real world.
By the way, explain the respective roles of you and your co-author, Niles Johnson Shelton. I mean, did you write this together, or otherwise, how was the responsibility of this shared between the two of you?
So there's so much that goes into the planning and execution of this series that there's no way I could do it alone. So Nils is an old friend of mine. We've been friends since before either of us had published a book. And we work well together. We get along great. We like the same kind of stuff. So I created the mythology of the series and wrote sort of an overarching outline of how it would all work and the stories. Then for each of the books, we sit down and write a very, very detailed, usually 50-page outline together, which lays out all the beats, all the plot points, all the character moves. And then we just take turns writing different sections of the book. Nils will write a section, I'll write a section. We go back and forth with the drafts. It's very, very collaborative.
And so you are also responding to each other's writing and sharing the responsibility in that way?
Yeah. And then along the way, we're managing everything else, the social media, the YouTube, the puzzles, the video game. We're leaving the movie to the filmmakers, but we manage and work with the people who make everything else.
We're talking with James Frey, and we're talking about his latest book, Sky Key, an Endgame novel. It follows up on his blockbuster bestseller, Endgame, The Calling. This is part of a trilogy which follows 12 teenagers playing a life-and-death game across the globe, trying to save their own lives, and not just that, their own bloodlines, and really, overall, trying to save the world itself. Tell our listeners, especially those not familiar with this mythology in which you've created, describe the state of the world which we find ourselves in Sky Key.
So the sort of overriding mythology of Sky Key, I love conspiracy theories and I love that TV show Ancient Aliens.
Right, right.
So the mythology is that 12,000 years ago, aliens created humanity, that they helped us get started. And when they did it, they created 12 original civilizations around the world. And they said that someday the world would end, and when it did, a game would be played, and each of these civilizations had to keep somebody prepared to play that game in perpetuity. So for thousands and thousands of years, these societies have existed in secret and kept people prepared to play this game. The people are highly trained. They know multiple languages. They're hackers. They're assassins. They're masters of disguise. They learn at the beginning of the first book that Endgame is the hunt for three keys, that three keys have been hidden around the world. The first of them to physically possess those keys wins the game. There's a lot of action and excitement and adventure in the first book, and at the end of the first book, the world learns of Endgame, learns that the world is potentially about to get destroyed, and that there is a massive extinction-level asteroid moving towards the planet. Over the course of the second book, the world starts to fall apart as Many people think the world is going to end, and other people are doing everything they can to prevent that from happening. I'm not going to tell you what happens in the third book because I don't want to give anything away.
Fair enough. One of the things that's striking about the book is that as we first encounter these 12 who are playing this game, we have rather little sense of who are the villains and who are the good guys and who should we be rooting for. And I suspect that that was really deliberate on your part to allow these characters to kind of unfold in a sense somewhat slowly and painstakingly, that nobody is branded unmistakably as a particular sort of character type. And that impressed me.
Yeah, and I think that's sort of how it is in the world, right? Like, there are very few people who are truly, truly evil, and there is almost no one who's truly, truly perfectly good. Most of us are sort of in between, and sometimes we're really good, and sometimes we make mistakes. And I thought that was the most realistic version of what these people would be like. They're human. They have their fears, they have their loves, they have their motivations, and they make mistakes. And I also think it while some of them are more bad and maybe more good, we also try to sort of constantly turn that around. Like, the characters who you think are good suddenly do bad things. Or the
right.
Characters who you think are bad suddenly do good things.
I appreciate
really,
that.
For me, it just makes for more exciting reading, right? Because you never really know what's going to happen, and your alliances with characters are constantly changing. And ultimately, that's what it's about. It's about, for me, it's about making an awesome reading experience for people.
I think it's exactly that. Absolutely.
You know, yeah, they spend their time and their money in my book. I want them at the end of it to feel like it was worth it and that they loved it.
Another thing I appreciate about it is that it's a story filled with violence, and violence often, you know, rather graphically described. You don't really pull punches or hold back on that. But one thing I appreciate is that the characters who experience violence, who sometimes themselves are inflicting it, these young people also bear the cost of that. And sometimes when we read in this genre, these kind of books, the violence sort of washes off of people so effortlessly, just like, you know, when you're done playing a video game, for instance, and then you go back to the rest of your life. That's not the case here. And the violence leaves its imprint. It leaves scars of one kind or another, which I think makes it also a much more interesting book than it would otherwise be.
Yeah, I wanted that the violence to be real and there to be real repercussions of it, and to make the reader feel that, right? I think too often in films and in television shows and in books, they have a premise of violence but then don't deliver on it, or if they do deliver on it, they, like you said, they just let it wash away. And the reality is, in a situation like we set up in the book, it would be an incredibly violent situation. And that when people engaged in violence, it would psychologically affect them and emotionally affect them in very real ways, and you would have to see them deal with it. It's definitely something that was intended from the beginning to be different, I hope, than a lot of other books in entertainment.
Right. I think it is. A last quick question. The writing style is also somewhat spare and simple, which I also really appreciate. Was that by design or for any particular reason?
I mean, that's just how I write. You know, all my books are written like that. It's kind of by design because I'm not that smart, and I didn't have that good of an education, and I believe in Occam's razor, which is keep things simple. That often the simplest answer is the best answer. So
right.
I write in a very direct, simple manner.
Well, and it's a complex, deeply layered story. So that also, at least for me, makes it all that much more accessible a world. Again, the book is Sky Key, an endgame novel, the second in a trilogy, and it is, of course, a fascinating example of convergent media with all sorts of other ways in which this story can be taken to the next level and experienced. The book itself, published by HarperCollins. James Frey, congratulations on all that you've accomplished with this, and best wishes with everything you're going to create in the future.
Thank you very, very much for having me. Have a great, great day.
The time is 8:25. You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. Now into the world of computers with two interviews, the second of which, towards the top of the hour, will be with the legendary Steve Wozniak, the co-founder of Apple. Again, you're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD, your gateway to public radio. I hope that you can enjoy, as I have, a book called The Digital Divide, Arguments for and Against Facebook, Google, Texting, and the Age of Social Networking. Our world, our society is changing so rapidly, and particularly for those of us of a certain age who very much remember the world as it once was, it can really be bewildering to think of how much has sort of evaporated into the ether and how much has changed about the way we communicate, entertain ourselves, the way we interact with the world and learn about the world. Mark Bauerlein, a best-selling author, has really followed this topic and explored it thoroughly in this new book. He is a professor of English at Emory University. He's written all kinds of interesting essays and reviews on the topic. The Digital Divide, available in paperback, is published by Jeremy Tarcher, a division of Penguin Groups. In this, he assembles the writing of a number of key thinkers and really provocative writers exploring this topic from several different angles. And we have Mark Bauerlein with us for a few minutes to talk about The Digital Divide. Mark Bauerlein, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
I am glad to join you.
I happen to be, in addition to this life on the radio, a assistant professor of music at our local liberal arts college. So I was really taken by the fact that you happened to write this wearing, among other hats, a professorship of English. And I wonder if you could just say a really quick word about what you have observed among your students and how that has affected the kind of educator that you are and affected the way you do what you do in the classroom on a daily basis.
Well, one of the things I've noticed over the years is that students are more ambitious. They're more achievement-oriented. More of them come to college having logged several AP courses, and they often have professional ambitions. You know, they want to go to graduate school. And so the desire is there, the motivation. But I'm in English. I'm in a humanities field where we're looking at things like becoming a well-read individual, knowing history, getting some historical understanding. So you see the long perspective on things happening today. And in that area, the sort of broad intellectual cultivation, I see a serious deterioration. Students may be ambitious, but they don't care very much about what happened on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in summer of 1963. They don't see how what happened, you know, 100 years ago is supposed to affect them. They're pretty career-oriented these days. And if they don't see a pretty quick payoff, then it just isn't interesting to them. Now, another area of deterioration is reading and writing skills. They don't write as well as they used to, and they don't read as much as they used to. And this comes into digital age habits. I mean, they read and write more words than ever before in human history. I mean, a teenager with a cell phone today averages 3,339 text messages per month, sending or receiving. That's according to Nielsen research. They are constantly emailing and instant messaging or going to Facebook, writing comments, filling out their page. And so the words passing back and forth and the images passing back and forth never stop. But the kind of writing they do and the audiences they do it for and the reading that they do, it's all youth stuff. I mean, 17-year-olds are sending those text messages, and 99% of those text messages are about themselves and their friends. They're doing Twitter posts, if they are, and they're cultivating, you know, these short little blips of a sentence. So when when it comes time for me to assign a 10-page research paper, that for them might be equal to writing a 600-page treatise on something. It's so different. It's so much longer and slower than the writing they're used to. And the reading, I hand them a 250-page novel, and to them, it seems like us, digital immigrants, reading the entire Encyclopedia Britannica. Because all the reading they do is quick, short, chunks of text with, bullet points and visuals and or little tiny text messages. So their reading and writing has just pared down to the fast, easy, and short. And too many academic activities really cultivate the slow, the long, and the plodding. And it's for a totally different audience as well. So what the digital age habits have done is actually make them almost feel estranged from academic work in my field. Reading long books, writing careful papers in eloquent language.
And I can tell you it's done the same in the music field, for instance, on the topic of opera, which I teach, to have a student sit and watch an opera start to finish, or one act of an opera start to finish, or a scene of an opera start to finish, when they are used to consuming their music in much tighter, smaller, hard-hitting chunks.
All right, make them sit for the final exam. They have to spend all week listening to the entire Ring of the Nibelung. Look, and I know this because I grew up in a household in which I woke up to the thundering strains of Wagner, Mahler, or Bruckner all the time.
All expansive composers for sure. Well, why don't you have one of your colleagues try that at Emory first, and you can let me know how it works. So let's explore a couple things which you say in the introduction to your book, and let's remind our listeners it's called The Digital Divide, and then we'll get to a few of the essays that are also collected in this really fascinating book. You just made mention, and I don't remember if it's in your introduction or elsewhere in the book, about digital natives. I think it actually is Mark Prensky's essay, which is the first in the book, but the distinction between digital natives and digital immigrants. I think this is an important distinction, no matter which characterization happens to fit a given person. It's good for people to know about these two sorts of people in the world right now.
This actually was an important essay. It came out about 10 years ago by Mark Prensky, Digital Natives, Digital Immigrants. And what Mark did was identify a new generation gap. We had the old generation gap in the 60s. The new generation gap opened up in the 90s when he found that young people who were growing up with screens around them, when they're 8, 9, and 10 years old, their classrooms have computers in them. Ours didn't. I'm 52 years old. And Mark said, this means that their minds have developed in a digital world. They're digital natives. Us old folks, we come to these digital tools, including laptops, having grown up in a book world, a paper magazine, paper newspaper world. And so our minds interact differently with these tools than do the digital natives. They're the early adopters of new technology. They're much more facile in their handling of these tools. We're a little slower in picking them up and learning how they work. And Mark's point was that these digital natives should be heeded by teachers. Teachers need to adapt to them, because we can get good, intelligent things happening out of video games. We can make them learn better by using these tools in the classroom. And so he actually comes down on the exact opposite side of the dumbest generation thesis. But I wanted to get him in the book, and I wanted to get intelligent, contrary voices out there, one reason being that this digital revolution is such a confusing, and overwhelming thing.
So in other words, the heart and soul of this essay is somewhat contrary to the perspective you take in your best-selling book, The Dumbest Generation. But this book is not about your opinion, as it is about gathering some variant voices on this question of how the world has been changed, and is it changed for good or ill, or what is the combination of the two?
Right. We almost have a little culture war taking place over the nature of these digital tools in people's personal lives. We know that they are miraculous in science and medicine and transportation and logistics and so on. But in people's personal lives, their leisure time, their off hours, do they really improve human life? Do they make people more intelligent, more thoughtful, and so on? That's where the questions lie. And who knows? I mean, I have my opinion, but I know that things are so complicated, and we're in the middle of it right now, so we need to hear a lot of different voices. And this book tries to stage the debate with the smartest people who've weighed in on it. And one of the regrettable things about the Internet is that it allows people to groove their contacts. They get news feeds or newsletters or emails, or they make bookmarks on websites that are already matched to what they believe and are interested in. They never need to encounter a voice that disagrees with them if they don't want to. And so you create, you know, one person called it the daily me, so that everything's a reflection of you. And there's something comforting about that. I mean, it's nice to belong. It's nice to feel like your ideas are confirmed. But that's not conducive to intellectual growth. That's conducive to complacency. And so we need to expose people to different sides of complex culture value-heavy questions, such as this one. And in this volume, we've got people all across the board, people who think that Wikipedia is a tremendous advance in collective human intelligence, others who think Wikipedia is the downfall of knowledge. So let's hear both arguments and let people make up their own minds.
I do appreciate something you say about the fact that because this has all overtaken us so quickly in what you call at one point a sign of mass adoption, that one of the things that happens is that we tend not to, in a sense, always fully appreciate it. You write, the popularity of these sites and actions has a paradoxical side effect. They appear altogether ordinary. People use them too much to register for very long their wondrous arrival. Digital tools have proven so efficient and compelling and helpful that it now requires a leap of imagination to recall what life was like before their advent. And, of course, particularly for the digital natives, where this is the only world they know. But even for some of us who are the immigrants, you really have to stop and think about what life was like before email. And we really have to think about our capacity to take these kind of incredible breakthroughs entirely for granted.
I know. You know, a guy was let out of prison in Georgia after being inside for about 30 years. And he was asked, well, what has changed most about your surroundings? And he said, cell phones. Everyone's on these cell phones all the time. Now, we look at people walking by on cell phones and think nothing of it. His perspective is a reminder. This is something so new in the full course of time. It just happened. So we need those reminders. We need to find out what life was like before them, if only to get a little bit of broader awareness of who we are and what we're doing, especially the young. And they are in a position, the digital natives, they've been there all along. The digital immigrants, we remember what life was like if we try hard. We remember what life was like before the digital revolution. But the thing is, we're going to be gone in a few decades. And everyone will have grown up in a digital age from then on. Our memories are going to be quite temporary. And so it's going to take an even greater leap of imagination for the young to see the world. I mean, you know, they'll go into a museum and they'll see an installation of an office from 1984 that had no computers in it. That will be that will be a historical curiosity. 1984. Things move fast, and we assimilate the tools so thoroughly. I mean, I think I mentioned YouTube itself. YouTube is a stunning advent. And if you can go look at a video. I can go click and get a little video of Jack Kerouac reading from On the Road on the Steve Allen Show in 1958. That's amazing. But for most people, ho-hum. Oh, yeah, YouTube. Yeah, oh, okay, let's get it up on YouTube. And they might be interested in the content passing through it, the film they're watching. But the website itself is about as ordinary as you know, the dresser over there in the bedroom.
Right, if that.
Yeah.
Back to your introduction. You start out with the story of something in the Wall Street Journal about this very controversial book called Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother, in which the author kind of talks about the superiority of Chinese mothers over Western mothers. And, of course, it created a firestorm of controversy. And just on this single website alone, where this article was written about the book, 4,383 comments were logged by various people reacting to it. And you posed the question, is this democratic participation or fruitless vanity? I mean, is there some purpose served by all of those people climbing aboard and stating their own opinion? I mean, if you can't even sort through them all, I mean, nobody would sit through and read many of those things. So what does each one of them, how do they matter? And how are we sort of, how does that affect what we think in the big picture matters in our world?
You know, they did that excerpt from the Tiger Mother, and it's written by an Asian American mother writing about how Asian styles of parenting are so superior to American styles. What are Asian styles? You work, you do your homework, you take your lessons, your music lessons, no TV, no video games, no sleepovers. You know, you get A's or you're in big trouble. The American style, she says, oh, it's about fun. It's about indulgence. The kids come home from school and your first question is, did you have fun today? Well, obviously, this sparked all kinds of controversy. And the thing about the web environment was it only took a few hours for this to start spreading. You saw editorials, op-eds, commentaries on blogs, commentaries going up on magazine websites within a day or two. So it circulated so quickly. And then all those comments at the Wall Street Journal piled up. That 4,000 number, I'm sure it got a lot bigger. It might have reached 6,000 after a few days after I looked at it. And you know, I had to wonder, if you're reading the story and 4,221 comments have been posted so far, do you really believe that the 4,222nd comment is significant? I mean, do you think anyone's going to look at this? Well, they don't think that way. They just think, I want my voice to be heard. I'm going to say what I think and post it on the Wall Street Journal website. Well, you just wonder, you know, is this a form of the people's voice? Or is it just empty gesture that makes people feel good?
And is it fostering some kind of new narcissism that we haven't really seen before exactly in this form? Go ahead.
One thing I've noticed is you know, for a while there, people were talking about the blog world. Blogs were really incredible. They're really important. Well, what I looked when I browsed the blog world, the number of blogs that people start and made commentaries that would have zero comments on them over and over and over again. And I after a while, I wondered, why are you doing this? Nobody is listening. No one is paying attention. Now, that's sort of an unpleasant message that you want to you tell people. But, yeah, one wonders if it's just this is just a matter of narcissism.
Hmm. Andrew Keen's essay is on what some call Web 2.0, the Web 2.0 movement, which he talks about fusing 60s radicalism with the utopian eschatology of digital technology. So he says this is an ideology which worships the creative amateur, the self-taught filmmaker, the dorm room musician, the unpublished writer. It suggests that everyone, even the most poorly educated and inarticulate among us, can and should use digital media to express and realize themselves. Web 2.0 empowers our creativity. It democratizes media. It levels the playing field between experts and amateurs. And those are fighting words for some. I mean, some would really take umbrage at it being characterized like that. I suspect you see some truth in what Andrew Keen is saying there. I mean, yeah. I think you share his concern.
Look, I think that if we want our culture not to sink to the least common denominator, we have to have gatekeepers. And those gatekeepers, one has to acknowledge, are going to have some forms of expertise and some improved abilities to distinguish the good from the not so good. You know, when Andrew did a spot on Stephen Colbert show, Stephen Colbert says, "So you're saying that, you know, we should keep culture in the hands of just an elite group, people who are knowledgeable and tasteful and so on, while the rest of us are just a bunch of pig farmers." And Andrew didn't back off. He said, "Well, what's wrong with that?" The entire audience booed him. But he was giving an unwelcome truth. Some people are more talented and more discerning than others. And those people should have decision-making power, or we're going to end up with a culture flooded with mediocrity or vulgarity. And unless you try to limit what is allowable, what gets published or what gets produced, what gets filmed, what gets recorded, what can go on the radio, then you're going to end up with piles of mush. Now, it's true, sometimes those elite gatekeepers make mistakes, and they rule out something that could be really worthwhile. And we hear stories about, you know, this book, this great novel being turned down by 20 publishers before one publisher picked it up and went with it. Okay. That certainly happens. But I think those stories are, in fact, pretty rare. And maybe the tragic fact is that the more mediocrity you allow into a space, the more it crowds out superiority. That you can't just open the world to a wonderful marketplace of everything and expect the cream to rise to the top.
Right.
Mark Bauerlein, and his book is titled The Digital Divide. It's 11 minutes before 9 o'clock, and you're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. And now an exciting interview, if a brief one, from The Morning Show archives.
For a precious few minutes, I have the pleasure and honor of speaking with Steve Wozniak, who helped reshape the world by reshaping the computers that you and I now take for granted. But it was really Steve Wozniak, more than anybody, who came up with the concept that became the personal computers first produced by Apple and then, of course, by other countries around the world. He has a wonderful new memoir called I Was, Computer Geek to Cult Icon, How I Invented the Personal Computer, Co-Founded Apple, and Had Fun Doing It.
published by W.W. Norton & Company. And Steve Wozniak, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, glad to be here.
I've enjoyed this book. I have to ask you something about the way it's written. You have a co-conspirator in the writing of the book, but I have to say that this book sounds so spontaneous. It does not sound particularly well scrubbed, like an editor has really taken to it and rubbed all the rough edges away. It sounds just like you talk.
Yes, I have no book experience, but Gina said we should get an agent. We got an agent. He sold the book. In each of the book publishers that bought it, they contacted me on the phone, and they said, we want to do this book, but we want it in Steve's voice. So what I did was I spoke into a tape recorder. Gina, you know, edited it together. Then we went through it paragraph by paragraph to make sure that it sounded the way I talk naturally in the world, for genuineness. I love genuine.
Well, that's certainly what this book is. I have really enjoyed it so thoroughly. One of the things that you do in your book is that you really give credit where credit is due in terms of how you came to have this marvelous genius for inventing new things. And we see that credit being given to a number of different people, but in particular, some of the teachers who really nurtured these promising gifts you had as a young person.
Very lucky. Actually, one teacher made me so inspired that I really believed in wanted to be a teacher like her someday, teaching fifth grade, which I did in my life. It's in the book. I also had another teacher in electronics who found a way to get me educated in a company outside of school where they had computers that we didn't have, something he felt that I could learn about.
Something that was interesting, too, about computers, one of the first things when you saw them, and even back in the days when they were huge and not accessible to regular people, you said computers were actually kind of simple the closer you looked at them. And this is part of the insight which helped you develop them for all of us to use.
That's the funny thing. Computers work on zeros and ones. I mean, we've already learned how to add digits 0 through 9. So zeros and ones, you learn how to add them, and you say, well, God, anybody can learn this. You don't need calculus. You don't need trigonometry. You don't need differential equations.
One of the things that was interesting about your personality, maybe to this day, is that you were quite a shy person, and you said that your clever designs were in some ways a more comfortable way for you to communicate with others, to socialize with others through the designs you made.
It was a huge advantage to me that I had a lot of very unusual techniques. Actually doing anything unusual, different than other people did, would get a little bit of attention that I had no way to get on my own, being so shy.
One of the greatest things about your story is that you visited a group called the Homebrew Computer Club back in 1975, a bunch of people like you who are interested in computers, but you kind of misunderstood what that group was about, and if you hadn't had that misunderstanding, you probably never would have gone to that first meeting. Explain to our listeners what I'm talking about.
I was scared of things that I didn't know about, and I didn't know about these new chips called microprocessors that had evolved. I had sort of missed out on that, so I would not have gone to a meeting dealing with microprocessors, but a friend, just by coincidence, has said, it's a meeting for people with video terminals. I had just designed one. So I thought, God, I'll show off my design. I'll pass it out. I'll be a big star in this new club. So I went, and what I discovered was, oh, my gosh, I now know a formula for building this computer I wanted my whole life.
Well, and because you had been playing around with televisions and with things like that old game Pong and some other things, you were actually building up a technical know-how, which was really going to come in handy then when you created this new idea of a computer with a screen.
Yeah, well, I had the technical know-how from very early years, actually going back to elementary school, a very good computer know-how, and I got so good at designing things. But more than that, I like to do, when I came home from Hewlett-Packard working on calculators, I like to do other interesting electronic things of the day, like hotel movie systems. Pong games started up, the first video games, and so I actually designed my own versions. The only way I could ever get something was to build it myself because I couldn't afford to buy the real thing. And then I built a terminal that would talk to what was called the ARPANET, which is the early forerunner of today's internet, started by the U.S. military, by DARPA. It was called the ARPANET, and I discovered it, and I had to build a machine that could type to computers far away on this ARPANET just so I could, I don't know, feel proud that I had one. And so all these little things that I did all wound up converging on the Apple II computer eventually.
Hmm. One of the most extraordinary things about what you developed and began marketing, of course, with Steve Jobs and this new company called Apple, is that very early on in this process, you had no copyrights or patents on any of these things that you were designing and developing, and you would show it to everybody. There was this marvelous openness about the way you were doing this.
To me, the club was sharing and helping others get to a better place in life, and I was going to help other people build their own computer themselves. You can have your own. Here's the design. Copy mine. Steve Jobs came along later and said, let's start a company to sell a piece of it called a PC board for $40. And eventually, the local store talked us into selling whole computers. So we didn't really just go out gung-ho and say, let's start a computer company. And after the computer was designed and I was giving it out for free, we didn't say, let's start a computer company. Step by step, it's just that the demand was there.
A quick question about Apple. When it started, you said it was an engineering-centric model of a company. It became more of a marketing-driven company. That was something you were a little less comfortable with. Explain what that difference is.
Well, in Hewlett-Packard, where I worked, we built the products that engineers use to design other things. We built their oscilloscopes. We built their power supplies. We built their signal generators. We built their calculators, their engineering calculators. So we understood the market, and we were in control of deciding what products should come next. We had very good minds in that regard. The Apple II, the Apple I and II computers, I designed them all alone in my own room just for myself. And so it was easy to, so I was totally driven by engineering, what chips were available. When we started the company with real money, we brought in this marketing guy, and he said, no, the success is going to be really a marketing success. We have to be a marketing-driven company, understand needs of the users.
Interesting.
So Apple was run differently than Hewlett-Packard. But we weren't making products precisely for engineers. We were making them for everyday average people.
And for your own
engineer is not a good judge of that.
Right. But you were designing things for your own enjoyment, and the rest is history. The book is I Was, the author Steve Wozniak. Steve Wozniak, congratulations on a superb book, and I'm glad we got to talk about it today.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Greg.
Tomorrow on the morning show, a poet by the name of Afa Weaver, who is coming to the campus of Carthage. And on Friday, we talk about the current production of the Carthage Theater Department of the play Stage Kiss. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived at WGTD.org. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. Partly cloudy skies in our forecast today with a 20% chance of some afternoon rain. A high today of 73 degrees. Overnight cloudy, 20% chance of rain, low of 46 degrees. A sunny day tomorrow with a high of 63 degrees.